Everyone, welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States versus Maybane. Lieutenant Danielczak, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Parker, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Zoe Danielczak, and along with Colonel Matt Neely, I represent the appellant, HM2 Edmond Maybane. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
I picked up the gun, pointed it at, and then boom. That's when I saw a slump. The military judge prevented the members from considering this confession, the only confession in this case, when deciding who fired the fatal shot. This court should set aside the findings and the sentence for two reasons. First, the military judge did not apply controlling case law on evidence of third-party guilt. Under Chambers, the confession should have come in because there was some evidence to corroborate it. Under Holmes, the strength of the government's case could not keep it out. And second, this error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In Chambers v. Mississippi and Holmes v. South Carolina, the Supreme Court addressed the admissibility of third-party confessions. In Chambers, the court found that when an accused seeks to introduce evidence of third-party guilt, all that is needed to ensure that that statement is trustworthy is some evidence of corroboration. Here, though, the military judge fell into the trap that Holmes guards against, which is to say that just because the government's case appears strong does not mean that a third party's confession warrants exclusion. Between those two cases, what we have here is a confession that under Chambers was corroborated by some evidence.
Now, from your perspective, was it necessary for the videotape of the confession to come in, or was it sufficient that there was this cross-examination?
Your Honor, the cross-examination was not sufficient. The video needed to come in because that was the accused's entire case to defend against the state's case. Here, the cross-examination was limited to impeaching the witness, and the military judge then twice instructed the members that that could not be considered for its truth. So ultimately, the cross-examination simply does not suffice because it doesn't count, quite frankly, as for the appellant to present his own defense against the government's case.
Now, setting aside the issue of the military judge's instructions for a moment, why wasn't trial defense counsel begging for the military judge to keep out a four-hour videotape rather than admitting something that was much narrower?
I'm trying to understand your question.
So you had a four-hour videotape confession?
Yes, Your Honor.
The defense was seeking to have that four-hour videotape confession admitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
So was there ever a point, it's not clear on the record, was there ever a point when trial defense counsel said, here is a seven-minute piece of this that covers it?
Not to my recollection, Your Honor.
So that's my question. Why wasn't the trial defense counsel really just begging to have the military judge say, I'm not going to introduce a four-hour videotape? This is simply going to be a waste of time and relitigating this or litigating the issue. Why isn't that a problem here?
Your Honor, because ultimately the trial defense counsel preserves the issue that and is ripe for appeal. So I haven't contemplated an answer to your specific question, Your Honor, but here what I imagine the trial defense counsel wanted to do was ensure that the members had all of the information possible to them to allow them, as the finders of fact, to determine who fired the fatal shot, or at least to provide the members reasonable doubt that it wasn't HM2 Maybane.
So let me ask it a different way then. Would you be standing on firmer ground if trial defense counsel said, we've got this four-hour videotape, I've got this piece, whether it's 3 minutes, 7 minutes, whatever. Judge, we need to have this introduced. And the judge then said, no, I'm keeping it out. Would you have a firmer foundation to argue before us today that the military judge abused his discretion?
Your Honor, it would certainly be more helpful to my argument, yes. However, ultimately, the rules of evidence cannot be applied mechanically to defy the ends of justice. And here, sure, the trial defense counsel did ask for a four-hour video to be played, which for the military judge is a consideration when we're looking at waste of time. However, it cannot be a waste of time when we're talking about an accused's constitutional right to defend against the entirety of the government's case. And here we have a whodunit case where the appellant could not put on evidence to show who else did it or could have done it, or at the very least to put forth some reasonable doubt for the members to consider. That simply did not happen here because the military judge abused his discretion and did not apply the proper law. Under Chambers, had he applied the proper law, which is some evidence of corroboration, the military judge would have found that he would have needed to admit this evidence because there was evidence to support the statement, confession to NCIS.
Lieutenant Danielczyk, getting back to Chief Judge Olson's question about maybe asking for part or shorter part of this interview to come in. But is it a fair position to take that, well, I've asked for something. If it is admissible, it's up to the military judge to limit the remedy if he can to assuage or to allay any concerns he or she might have about a waste of time. Is that a position that the defense counsel obviously, the defense counsel could take that, but are they obligated to take that position?
No, you're not, Your Honor, they're not obligated. And
I'm not suggesting one way or the other.
No,
I don't want to get in a fight with the chief judge, but I want to know what your view is.
Certainly, to your point, the military judge could have told trial defense counsel, hey, I'll just limit it to those 7 minutes. I'll let you use those 7 minutes. He didn't do that because he was already so convinced by the strength of the government's case, which is what Holmes prohibits, that he made the conclusion himself that this was a false confession. That wasn't his job. His role is to be the gatekeeper of the evidence. His role is not to be the fact finder. And when he failed to admit this evidence and failed to apply the proper framework, that is the decision that he was robbing from the members. He took that decision away when he told the members, essentially, in essence, that Mabane did it because we did not. And that was not his place.
Let me ask you one other question here now. Aside from the issue of the judge determining that it might be a waste of time, the military judge indicated that this would be misleading. But it's not clear to me why this would have misled the members. I mean, the only thing I take away from it is that it misled them into acquitting the accused. Is that a proper or appropriate thing to be concerned about?
No, Your Honor. That's exactly what the role of the fact finder is, to determine whether or not the accused is innocent or guilty, or whether at the very
And I should say the record is not clear to me why he thought this would be misleading. And so that's why I'm kind of
correct. I couldn't agree with you more, Your Honor. The record's not clear to me either as to how this would be misleading.
Yeah, you don't have to agree with me, because then you'll get me mad across this.
Well, on that point, Your Honor, I agree with you.
All right.
But exactly that. The military judge doesn't make any sort of explanation as to how this would be misleading. And to your point, this is exactly what HM2 Mabane's defense would have been. It's a whodunit case. I didn't do it. I have evidence to at least raise reasonable doubt that I didn't do it because it could have been this other person. And the military judge failed to let that in simply because he did exactly what Holmes guards against, which is rely on the strength of the government's forensic case. He made a factual conclusion when he should have been making an admissibility determination. And in making that conclusion, he failed to apply the right framework, the right legal framework. He simply misapplied the law, and that is an abuse of discretion. Between the two cases of Chambers and Holmes, as I mentioned, we have the confession. That under Chambers was corroborated by some evidence.
Counsel, why do you think Chambers controls our trustworthy analysis here? So Chambers is really, it is a Sixth Amendment case, but it's really a Confrontation Clause case where the jury was not allowed to hear cross-examination about this statement. But here we were. Plus, Chambers is a case from 50 years ago, and 807 is a new rule. Why do you think that Chambers and that paragraph about trustworthiness and about whether another exception to the hearsay rule could have applied sort of generically, why does that govern so strictly 807 today?
Well, Your Honor, Chambers definitely was a two-piece issue, right? There was the issue of the Confrontation Clause, but the analysis on Chambers really turns on the hearsay rule that was relevant in that case. And we, which dealt specifically with the accused in that case, Sixth Amendment right to present a complete defense. And to this point, we don't
know. But what the court said the real issue was that the jury didn't get to hear the testimony be tested and decide for itself whether or not it believed it. But didn't that happen in this case?
Your Honor, at first glance, it certainly looks like that happened, but it didn't because of the military judge's instruction. Twice, he instructed the members, first, that any testimony that they heard as to being the shooter could not be considered as substantive evidence. And then he doubled down on that when he explained that counsel's argument was just that. So any argument on behalf of counsel that would have been the shooter could not be considered as evidence. So it's essentially a wash, Your Honor. The members could not consider it for its truth. And it left the appellant without a way to viably defend against the entirety of the government's case. So because we in our system do not have any case law that specifically deals with 807 as it relates to an appellant's right to present a complete defense, Chambers is what should guide our analysis here and what should have guided the military judge's analysis when determining whether or not confession bore sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness, which is some evidence of corroboration. Was he there to be cross-examined? And was it against his self-interest? Yes, yes, and yes. It should have been admitted. The military judge failed to admit it here, and that's where he abused his discretion.
I also want to ask you about Holmes.
Yes, sir. Yes.
I forgot what it was I wanted to ask. In Holmes, so the new rule in 807, it specifically says to determine trustworthiness, the judge should consider the totality of the circumstances. But you seem to be suggesting the judge couldn't consider the forensic evidence because it was so powerful for the prosecution. I don't really know how we carve that exception out of the totality of the circumstances.
So what the military judge did here was he essentially picked apart what forensic evidence he wanted to consider while also ignoring the forensic evidence that corroborated the statement. So here he references the forensics and the ballistics, but what he doesn't consider is the fact that there was gunshot residue, that he was within the trajectory cone of where the shot originated, that he was pointing the weapon at the decedent and dry-firing it at him earlier that night. So he considers all of...
And we say we think he didn't consider this because he doesn't mention it in his ruling.
Well, he doesn't tell us exactly what he's considering, but based off of his ruling, we know what he was ignoring in that forensic and ballistic report. He specifically talks about the entrance and exit wound, but that's really all he kind of bases his judgment off of, instead of looking at exactly that, at the totality of the circumstances. He had gunshot residue. He was firing at the witness, or at the decedent earlier that night. He was in the room. This isn't like a typical third-party defense that we see borne out in case law where it's just this random person on the street that the accused wants to point at. That's not what we have here.
And you're quite rightly pointing to all the things that are in appellant's favor. But there are other things, right? It sounds like the military judge watched the video. It sounds like there were other things. So if this boils down to a question where reasonable people could have disagreed about whether this evidence should come in, doesn't that fall squarely within our abuse of discretion standard? Because I think you were quite clear, and I appreciate this in your brief, that this was not a facial challenge against 807. You acknowledge that the military judge has broad discretion. You acknowledge that the president has the authority to create hearsay rules that keep out certain evidence, right? You're not attacking any of those things facially. So this all comes down to whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And here he did, because there was evidence to corroborate this statement. There were sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness here that the military judge should have just simply been making an admissibility determination and allow the members to decide whether or not they bought it, whether or not they believed the appellant's defense. That was for the members to make, not for the military judge.
So, Counsel, so it was, that's the first prong of 807. Is it also your position that because the military judge decided that the confession was not trustworthy, he never moved to the second prong? So is it appellant's position that that's also error, that his failure to even address the probative value is error?
Yeah, well, yes, Your Honor, it goes to the point that the military judge should not do a complete analysis. But more than just to say that the confession wasn't trustworthy, he decided that it was a false confession. He made a conclusion that this confession was false, ultimately determining for the members that did not do it, he could not have done it. And that is simply not borne out in the record. The record does not support such a factual conclusion. This error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Without this confession was the foundation for appellant to be able to defend against the entirety of the government's case. And without it, appellant had no meaningful way to argue third-party guilt. Allowing impeachment, but not the confession for its truth, completely gutted appellant's defense. And the government's case here was not airtight. We're talking about a case that was reliant on conflicting testimony from folks that were at this party who had been intoxicated and who had differing stories up until that day they were testifying under grants of immunity. So here, the appellant, armed with this confession, could have been acquitted had he been able to present that to the members. And simply, this is what the case boils down to, Your Honors.
How do we measure that? I mean, let's suppose that, suppose the court decides, and I'm not saying they will, what if the court decides there's no constitutional error, but this is a violation of 807, and then we're looking at a lower standard on prejudice? How do we, on this record, measure that, assess that?
Yes, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I please quickly answer?
Oh, I wasn't watching the clock. Sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. So if we were just looking at it under 807 and it doesn't rise to beyond a reasonable doubt, then we'd be looking at it under Kerr. And under Kerr, we have the four-factor analysis. One, strength of the government's evidence. Here, I submit that this government's evidence was weak. It was reliant on people testifying who were under grants of immunity, who had been inconsistent up until trial.
Well, why does that make it weak, just because they're testifying under a grant of immunity?
Your Honor, it also makes it weak because they could not remember clearly throughout their statements that they were making at NCIS. So that would be obviously ripe for impeachment or present for as prior inconsistent statements. Then we turn to the defense's case, and it takes us back to the point that with this confession, the accused could have had a complete defense. He could have had more tools in their toolkit to defend against the entirety of the government's case. And then we look at the materiality and the quality of the evidence. Evidence of someone else committing this crime is certainly material. And the quality of the evidence, we're talking about this person's own words against his interest. So here, when we do this Kerr analysis, it almost takes us right back into the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt arena, because this is a constitutional issue. Appellant did not get a right to a fair trial here. And all that we're asking is, at the very least, he get that right. He gets his full day in court, and he gets to present his complete defense.
Chief, Counsel, the way you're arguing Chambers and the way you just made your essentially a prejudice analysis, it sounds like there's no situation in which there was another person who confessed to the crime where that shouldn't come in under 807. That's virtually a per se rule that is, because it's always against their penal interest, that it's should always come in under 807.
Not at all, Your Honor. If that's only one of the factors, whether it's against their self-interest. But also, is there some evidence to corroborate? In some cases, this is somebody that's not even at all related to the crime, that wasn't even there, that an accused wants to point out to say, oh, this random guy on the street did it. That's not what we have here. We do have some evidence. And it is rare that this happens, but this is that rare case where an accused has somebody who was there. There's some corroboration of his confession. He's the only person that confessed this crime, and he doesn't even get to say, this other guy did it. That is patently unfair and defies the logic of our military.
And is it ultimately the military judge's duty and responsibility to decide whether or not there's sufficient corroborating evidence?
It's his duty to decide if there is some corroborating evidence, and if yes, to admit. Here, there is some corroborating evidence.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Daniel Check. Lieutenant Parker.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Matt Parker, and along with Colonel Ian Pedden, I represent the United States in this matter. An accused does not have a constitutional right to untrustworthy hearsay statements. Thus, this court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he found statements untrustworthy and excluded them under MRE 807. And second, even if this court finds error, appellant was not prejudiced. As the court itself said in Chambers, the accused, as is required of the state, must comply with established rules of procedure and evidence designed to assure both fairness and reliability in the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. And MRE 807 is one such rule that tests the reliability of a hearsay statement. And this court supplied factors for a military judge to consider whether or not a statement is trustworthy under MRE 807 in United States v. Donaldson.
Now, here the military judge specifically found that there was no unlawful inducements, no improper coercion, said that the person who gave this testimony was lucid, intelligent, was following the questions. And the military judge said the reason I don't believe this testimony or the confession that was made is because of coaching and suggestive questions and repetition. We see a number of petitions where these issues are thrown up for confessions for an accused all the time. And the government is saying, of course that statement comes in. There was no unlawful inducements. There was no improper influence. Coaching doesn't matter. Suggestive questions don't matter. And yet here, when it suits the government standing here and say, military judge made absolutely the correct decision here. Can you please address that?
Yes, Your Honor. For both voluntariness of confessions and for trustworthiness of a statement, it is a highly fact-specific inquiry looking at the totality of the circumstances.
So what are you focusing on here? We know what the military judge focused on, things such as, well, he was fearful because he was being accused of a crime, and he had a lack of sleep. We see that all the time. And the government is saying, no problem. So what are the specific facts here that you're pointing at?
Specifically for suggestive questioning, Your Honor, the military judge's finding that Pedden was sleep-deprived is not clearly erroneous. If you look in the joint appendix at page 500, he states in his third interview where he recants that he only got about an hour of sleep last night. So the military judge's finding of fact there was not clearly erroneous.
So the finding of fact, but how does that lead us into a conclusion that it was appropriate to eviscerate the defense?
Your Honor, because it was just one factor of many that the military judge considered. And so ultimately where the military judge starts is that the forensic evidence makes it highly unlikely, if not impossible, that it was the shooter.
Now, wait a minute. You're going off the path here.
Yes, sir.
So I'm asking, what was it that the military judge is pointing to? What can we look to say that he made that was not improper for the military judge to conclude this? It's not a situation where after the person who made the confession got some sleep, got out of that environment, that he came back and said, I don't know why I just did that. It took him 12 days. 12 days to say, you know what? What I admitted to, flat out admitted to, That was wrong. And yet the military judge is saying unilaterally, I'm not going to let the panel members consider that for the truth of the matter asserted.
So 2 points, Your Honor. First, I would respectfully disagree with the characterization that the first time says, I didn't do this, was 12 days later. In fact, testifies, and you can see in the record at page 1324, that the seconds out of that second interview, he tells, I think I just admitted to something I didn't do, and then he calls.
So he doesn't go back to law enforcement for 12 days?
He does not go back to law enforcement, Your Honor. It is not until he is represented by counsel that he makes this recantation to NCIS, but he does make statements inconsistent with culpability right after that second interview. And in fact, during that first interview, statements are not consistent. For the first 30 minutes of that interview, he is repeatedly and consistently saying, I don't remember what happened. And then once Special Agent Thompson switches and uses more closed-ended questioning and says, look, the evidence says you did it, so was it an accident?
So we're going to see the government in the near future, come up here and say, you know what? Military judge made a mistake when he or she admitted this confession of the accused. We, the government, say, oh, they were closed-end questions. Oh, my God, the special investigator actually asked things that were suggested. Ooh, it's a situation where he didn't get as much sleep as he should have. That's what we're going to see the government saying going forward?
I would say no, Your Honor, because this is a totality of the circumstances analysis, and the government's position in this case is just that the military judge's finding of fact was not clearly erroneous with respect to suggestive questioning, which this court in United States v. Donaldson said was an appropriate factor for a military judge to consider regarding the trustworthiness of the statement.
But counsel, did not the CCA find that the military judge failed to consider important facts, and they identified that as error?
Yes, Your Honor, and 2 points to that. First, I think it can be reasonably inferred from the military judge's findings that the corroborating circumstances of guilt were not outweighed by the corroborating circumstances that was not the shooter. The only evidence presented at the motions hearing where the military judge made those findings were that texted about the victim, in that case 30 minutes prior or so, saying he's annoying. As United States v. Moore said, right, there can be corroborating circumstances of shootings, but there can also be corroborating circumstances that don't get to the actual killing. And so what I think the military judge relies on is the fact that even if you have these text messages, even if you have a dinner plate that's to the right, looking at the forensic evidence in this case, even when makes inculpatory statements, he is doing it in the context of he is on the left of the victim in this case. And the NCIS agent is adamant that the evidence says that the shot was fired from the left. And so what he's saying is, if that's what all the evidence points to, and he uses the words, you can't argue evidence, he is mirroring and adopting the story that the NCIS agent is feeding him in this case. And so the military judge finding this to be not corroborating circumstances of guilt, but in fact independent evidence that is contrary to guilt, this was not clearly erroneous. So the military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion.
Didn't point the weapon earlier in the evening and dry fire the weapon while he had it pointed at the victim in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. And ultimately, though, looking at where the bullet ended up, when he makes these statements that he's on the left of the victim and the bullet ends up on the left of the victim. And every eyewitness who provided testimony and a recreation of that scene testifies that he's on the left of the victim. And the shot could not have originated on the left based off where it ended up. So the military judge's finding of fact that being the shooter was highly unlikely, if not impossible, was not clear error, making his inculpatory statements to NCIS untrustworthy and thus excludable under MRE 807.
Counsel, so how do we reconcile Holmes with everything you just said about the forensic evidence? So Holmes is dealing with DNA evidence, but it seems to suggest sort of like proof that somebody else did it can't be used to undermine someone else's confession to the crime. It seems pretty analogous to the situation we have here where we have sort of definitive forensic evidence that says somebody else did it. Why wouldn't we then say, under the logic of Holmes, that that can't undermine someone else's confession?
Your Honor, I would disagree that forensic evidence said someone else did it. Forensic evidence said the bullet ended up on the left side of the victim. That isn't a reflection of who fired the shot. It is statements and the eyewitness testimony. The military judge didn't consider any evidence that included the appellant's guilt. What he was looking at was innocence, basically, and that the fact that all these witnesses and himself state he's on the left, that's not evidence of guilt of the appellant. It's just making the evidence that was the shooter untrustworthy. So
didn't
I think that
forensic evidence demonstrate that he was close to the discharge of the firearm?
Yes, Your Honor. And pointing to the Federal Rules of Evidence manual, understanding that it's not binding authority on this court, but persuasive, the court must consider not only the existence of corroborating evidence, but also the strength and quality of that evidence. And so it is perfectly within the realm of the military judge's discretion to consider, yes, there was gunshot residue, but defense's own expert testified that gunshot residue doesn't tell you who fired the weapon, and that based off the limited amount of gunshot residue, it couldn't even tell you if they got it from cross-contamination, from a surface, or another person. And so the military judge's ultimate finding that the forensic evidence meant was unlikely to be the shooter was not clearly erroneous in this case.
So, counsel, is it government's position then that the appellant's constitutional rights are not implicated? I'm thinking about Woolheater.
Correct, Your Honor. The government's position is that this can be resolved on evidentiary grounds, that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in excluding this evidence under MRE 807. Because MRE 807 specifically asked the judge to consider the totality of the circumstances and the reliability of the evidence. And that's what Chambers is asking judges to do and asking the rules of evidence to do. And so that's why this case is not Chambers, even as applied.
So why doesn't the constitutional right to be able to present a defense essentially outweigh that consideration under the rules?
It's not that the accused is not allowed to present a complete defense. It's that the rules recognize that you're not allowed to present untrustworthy evidence in support of that defense. And so the military judge's conclusion that this was untrustworthy evidence, looking at the totality of the circumstances, was not an abuse of discretion. And so there's no constitutional implication here because it was untrustworthy. And then turning again to Chambers, I would respectfully disagree that Chambers says you just need some evidence of corroboration. In fact, I think the words they use are persuasive assurances of trustworthiness. That, I think, is a higher bar, and it comports with MRE 807 that asks for sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness. And looking at Chambers, what you had in that case was a third party who made three spontaneous confessions to close acquaintances and made a fourth sworn confession to appellant's defense counsel. That is much different than this case, where the military judge's finding that this was not a spontaneous confession but the product of questioning by an NCIS agent, it was not clearly erroneous for the military judge to conclude that under Chambers. Additionally, eyewitnesses in Chambers testified that they saw the third party commit the shooting. You do not have that here. Every eyewitness testified that was on the left of the victim in this case. Two of the eyewitnesses testified that it was the appellant who fired the shot, and a third testified that immediately after the shot, they saw the appellant holding the weapon. And then finally in Chambers, what you had was another eyewitness who testified that immediately after the shooting, the third party was holding the gun. And the evidence showed that the third party owned the murder weapon, and then immediately after purchased the same murder weapon after he told close acquaintances that he had discarded it. So this case is factually distinguishable from Chambers. So this court should not look to Chambers for guidance in this case, where you don't have a spontaneous confession, where you don't have eyewitnesses who say that it's the third party did this, and in fact, based off their testimony and recreation of the scene, effectively eliminate the possibility that it was the shooter, or at the very least, makes the military judge's finding of fact not clearly erroneous in this case. And then turning to what cases this is analogous to, I think this court can look to cases like Rhodes v. Henry and United States v. Moore for the proposition that when you're dealing with third-party confessions, you still start with the applicable rules of evidence, provided that those rules of evidence test the trustworthiness of the third-party statement, which is exactly what happened in this case. What you had in Rhodes v. Henry was a third-party who gave spontaneous confessions to police. He provided accurate details about the shooting using details that were not available to the public. But he later recanted and he had alibi witnesses, and so the court in Rhodes excluded it because under statements against penal interest, there were not persuasive assurances of trustworthiness. They also considered the state of mind in the third party in that case. And so similar to here, yes, you have a third party confession, but ultimately what the military judge found is it was not trustworthy. In Rhodes, you had alibi witnesses who said the third party wasn't the shooter. And here you have eyewitnesses who place in a position in the room that makes it highly unlikely, if not impossible, that he is the shooter. And then looking at a case like United States v. Moore, the third party provided confessions to law enforcement, and his fingerprint DNA was found in that room. But what the court found in Moore is that even though there's fingerprint evidence in the room, that's not corroborating evidence that he necessarily did it. The other issue in Moore is that the third party gave inconsistent and conflicting statements to police. And what United States v. Moore says is that other circuits, and including now Moore, have held such contradictions alone can render a statement otherwise admissible and find it untrustworthy, and they cite to the Second Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit. And so what you have here is that in the first 2.5 hours of interviews, he is repeatedly and consistently denying culpability, saying, "I don't remember what happened." And even when he starts to make inculpatory statements, when the NCIS agent starts to close that questioning and saying, "Well, we know the evidence says you did it, so was it an accident or was it on purpose?" Even makes statements such as, "I honestly thought he shot himself, so that's what I told the cop." And twice, when he leaves the room after he starts making inculpatory statements, you can hear him whispering words to the effect of, "I don't remember doing this." Also stated, when about an hour and 11 minutes in, "Why didn't you tell us sooner that you shot it?" He said, I didn't know the evidence. I didn't know it all pointed to me. So the military judge's finding that these are half-hearted admissions and that they ultimately do not have sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness, those findings of fact were not clearly erroneous. They were supported by the record and supported by statements in that second interview, which, again, immediately when he gets out of that second interview, he tells the first person he sees, "I think I just admitted to something I didn't do," and calls his father and states the same. And so the military judge finding this recantation to be informative of the fact that the statement was not trustworthy is in line with a case like Rhodes, where the judge in that case considered the recantation of the third party to be a factor to consider as to why it was not trustworthy, and ultimately excluded it under, in that case, it was 804. But he was still looking at...
Lieutenant Parker, let me ask you one question here about the federal cases. Now, this situation seems to be a fairly rare occurrence. Would you agree with me there?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's a dearth of cases everywhere, and we don't have any in the military system. Not that I'm this extraordinary researcher, but I'm told there's a dearth of these kinds of cases where you have this scenario, as you've laid out for us in both parties' briefs. Now, what I'm going to ask is whether or not you think that we should rely on cases like Moore just because they're federal cases, or is the military justified in looking at these situations differently in a more protective way? In other words, for a military accused, is there any reason to believe that the military should do that? Or do you think that because of this kind of rare situation, that we should follow and be highly persuaded, because they're not binding, obviously, highly persuaded by the federal district courts and the federal circuits that have undertaken review of this issue? You see what I'm getting at here?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see a compelling reason to depart from the analysis, the analytical framework, at least, that cases like Rhodes v. Henry and United States v. Moore use. And the lower court even cites to a case, I think it's United States v. Burks, where the military court does have an opportunity to consider evidence of third-party guilt offered as a residual hearsay exception. And this court in Burks started with the rules of evidence and found that there were not sufficient or equivalent guarantees of trustworthiness. And so even this court, when offered the opportunity to look at third-party confessions, has started with the applicable rule of evidence. And so I do think the federal circuits can be persuasive evidence to this court, and I don't see a compelling reason, given that this court has also used that same framework of starting with the applicable rule of evidence. I don't believe it's necessary for this court to depart from those frameworks that those courts apply.
Mm-hmm. And, Chief, I know he's only got a minute left. One of the other things that's kind of bothering me, I don't say bothering, but I'm stuck on, is in the military judge's findings, he indicates that the accused was subjected to coaching and suggestive questioning, but he also concludes that there are no improper influences here. So are we to take from that suggestive questioning and and coaching, if you will, doesn't rise to the level of what he is referring to as an unlawful influence or the absence thereof? You see what I'm saying? The reason why I ask is it sounds inconsistent. In other words, if he says there's no unlawful influences, he also says the accused is subjected to this coaching, suggestive questioning. And so I'm only asking whether or not, and I don't want you to speak necessarily for the military judge, but what do you conclude? Do you conclude that the military judge, thinks that suggestive questioning and coaching don't rise to the level of unlawful influences? Because otherwise it seems kind of contradictory.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
Please respond.
So 2 points to that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. First, I don't think the military judge would have considered suggestive questioning, but for the fact that this court made suggestive questioning a factor to consider in United States v. Donaldson. So I think it would have been error to depart from considering that, and I don't necessarily think it's inconsistent. But then second, as this court stated in a case like United States v. Guihama, what it found is you can find the military judge to abuse their discretion with respect to part of the analysis, but if the ultimate conclusion that the statements weren't trustworthy enough to admit under 807 is good, then this court can find that ultimately it was not an abuse of discretion. And, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
Let me first check. Yes. Any further questions from the bench? Please briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion. Thus, this court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you,
Lieutenant Barker. Lieutenant Daniel Jack.
I don't want you confessing to anything you didn't do. That is what the special agent told. She didn't want him to be making this a false confession, which is ultimately the conclusion that the military judge makes. When we're talking about persuasive assurances of trustworthiness, we have that here. The government cites to Rhodes, but Rhodes simply is not applicable. He was intoxicated when he was questioned. He recanted once he was sober. He had an alibi that didn't even place him at the scene. There was no physical evidence tying Rhodes to the crime. And he couldn't be connected to the murder weapon. That is the complete opposite of what we have here. He was there. He had gunshot residue on him. He did not. He recanted 12 days later. He might have made a statement to his chief, but even when he was in the room with the special agent, after he confesses, he says, does this mean I'm going to go to the brig? Of course he has some sort of interest in not wanting to go to the brig, so he tells his chief, I think I might have confessed to something I didn't do, or words to that effect. Then it takes him another 12 days to reach out to law enforcement and recant his confession. Here, ultimately, the military judge should have looked to see whether or not there was some evidence. And the government concedes there was some evidence that could have done it. He should have left the fact-finding to the fact-finder. And that was the members. The military judge stepped outside of the bench and leapt into the jury box. And he essentially robbed the appellant from presenting his defense to the members. The appellant did not select judge alone court-martial. He elected to be court-martialed by a jury of his peers, and they didn't get to hear the only argument that he had in his arsenal, which is that someone else did it. And for those reasons, Your Honors, this court should reverse and set aside the findings because the appellant did not get his right to a fair trial. Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
All right. The court stands in recess until 10:25.